physical event relies on heterogeneity. So I'm restating the fact that there's those two collective bodies participating. So on one side, the creative practitioners, and on the other side, the spectators. So that's two collective bodies, which are both informed by individual bodies who will all take a different positioning, point of view on the event while contributing to it. Another thing that I haven't mentioned, which is possibly useful to have in mind, is that, well, depending on what era we're in, but if we consider the theatrical architecture, the space of where the theatrical event takes place in, let's say, mid-18th century in France, that spatial distribution will also impact forcefully on this multiplicity and distribution of points of view. There's a commonplace view that things that in classical era in France, perspective is oriented towards the prince's point of view, right? Which will be located where the king used to sit in the middle of the Théâtre Italien. But that is highly disputed by scholars working in that era, which I'm not, because I'm not a historian in theatre, but which is that even when the prince perspective was introduced with the creation of Théâtre Italien and court theatre, that was contradicted by the existence of all the other points of view existing at the level of the balconies, existing in the loggia, and also, because we tend to forget that, the fact that until, I think, 1756, spectators used to sit on stage, sitting and then standing. But that, so that proliferates the multiplicity of points of view that not only spectators look towards the stage, but they actually look at each other, and they look at each other being watched, and they look at each other looking at each other, etc., etc., etc. This is sort of specularity of gaze, right? That is at the center of, and we could say the same thing about the Greek amphitheater because of a round disposition, the circular sort of optical model that it's predicated upon. So, and also the fact that in the classical theater until the mid-19th century, there was no electricity. So basically the stage was badly lit. And you could see almost as much in the auditorium, let's call it the auditorium, as you would see on stage. The auditorium. You will see as much or as well where the spectators will be sitting than where the actors will be performing. And that's why Christian Bier, who's a specialist of our era, says that because actors are embedded in that relationship I was talking about between the spectators and the spectacle, and those very specific physical architectural dispositions, they had to make the action shown in a particular way because they were competing with the spectators and with this diffusion of attention. They were competing with those other modes of attention. So that adds maybe a layer of complexity to the understanding of the event. I don't know exactly how we can try and translate or transpose what you're saying about linguistics, like what is, I understand what you're saying about the main message and or several messages, because a theatrical event as a semiotic system is made out of so many different elements, again, complementing and competing with each other, that there is no centrality, or there's no, you know, especially in contemporary performance, but not only, you could say the same thing about a lot of historical theatrical performances or traditions like street theater or théâtre de tréteaux, etc., where bodily communication, spatial awareness were as important as verbal exchanges, if not more, or audience interaction. So it would be hard to pinpoint it. But maybe we can reflect, maybe there's something to be considered around narratives. So the idea that on stage there is something that is being told to us, whether or not actually the theatrical performance is narrative driven, there is always something that is being said to us, and I'm not saying a message, but something that is being proposed to us, to our understanding, whether that's an experience or a story or, an experience or a story. So maybe that is the thing that everyone, both the creative practitioners and the spectators, are trying to contribute to. And often when you work with an ensemble or a theatre company, you can hear things like, we are all here to tell the same story, or we are telling the same story together, but the understatement being but from different perspectives or from different understandings, but this idea that we are here to serve together this particular story or this set of narratives, or if you work in documentary theatre, for instance, to pay justice to those documents taken from your life, etc., etc. And that can be undermined or underpinned by the fact that there will be contradictory types of exchanges that will try and either undermine the main story that is being told on stage. So that is not my take on this story. This character will say, so Malvolio, for instance, in Twelfth Night, has a different take on the main plot. You know, there's also this idea, there's a distinction between in narrative theory between between main plot and subplot, etc. So maybe that could be an approach, like a sort of, maybe that's not the most original, but a sort of narrative-driven approach to this, sort of not finishing my sentence here, but I'm wondering how that could sort of answer at least partially your question, or address it at least.
Maybe Irene could answer also the previous questions, or if some of the questions...
Yes.
are waiting for your comments.
Thank you very much. I tried to address some of these issues. I don't think I can address all of them. As Chloe said, very rich, very good questions. So thank you very much. I might start with Jeremy's questions, which are very specific also. I have thought about some of them. Some go back to my graduate school time, an accusative, for example. But the meaning in natural language, that is, of course, a complex issue. And it does depend on your theoretical stance to, you know, how you approach it, what you get out of it, and what you want to get out of it. So since I'm mostly a cognitive linguist and a semiotician, I would like to offer one view that comes to my mind spontaneously. I'd like to think about this a little bit more. You said something that is underpinning the semantics, like telicity, underpinning the semantics that has also something to do with structure. So structure, meaningful structure, schematic meaning. According to my recent considerations, not recent, they have built up during the past 15 years, maybe. takes some time to get a grasp of these things. I would say that embodied image schemas, are a really good way to go. I cannot really go into this too much. I mentioned them earlier. Image schemas, according to Mark Johnson and George Lakoff and others, are these very minimal, basic structures of experience, like a path with a beginning, a trajectory and an end. A path has, you can also say, or a container has an interior and exterior and a boundary. A path has a beginning and an end. So these are these underlying structures that we have found in gesture. I'd also like to refer to the work by Dominique Boutet, Alia Morgenstern and Cornelia Müller and Ellen Czenki in Moscow. They are looking on aspect and gesture. And the boundary schema is very important there. So I would say that since these basic embodied structures, they are embodied through the body, and gestures are the body, no wonder that we don't have much time while talking. We're looking at the essence of meaning, the essence of certain experiences that we have internalized. So I can, of course, say, what did you say? Like, I read a book in 2 weeks or 4 weeks. Well, I can, in my gestures, I can very easily you know, evoke a container or a path. I have beautiful examples where somebody said, well, I watched the sitcom from the beginning until the end of the season. You know, so you have a path and you have a container because it's a period of you know, it's space representing time. So I would say that these basic structures or there are these force dynamics of resistance that you say, oh, I don't like that idea. You know, you feel this. It's a response to something. And you, when you talk about your own feelings about it, you can feel it and you can evoke it through your gestural behavior. The Paul Klee study, the big theme was balance. You know, the paper is called Balancing Acts. It's all about physical balance and how we do see the balance in these pictures, and even the gestures are balanced. They were all bimanual gestures, and the whole body was trying to evoke the balance. So I'm sure you can all relate to this from theater, dance. Balance is key, and balance is an image schema. So I would say that this, I recently wrote a paper on image schemas, gestures as image schemas and force gestalts. So I do think that these basic structures, movements are there, and they then can be elaborated. They can feed into matter from metonymy frames, and they can then, on the basis of that gestural evocation of these minimal dynamic patterns, then you can elaborate more, you know, complex meanings. So that's one point. And then there was something about être and avoir and the unaccusative. And I have thought about this some time ago. It's a little difficult to really understand what you are trying to get at in this very instance, but I do think this something about the entire body and the part of the body that is, of course, also metonymy. And so you use a part of the body to talk about the head. I mean, that's easy. You know, the head is a part of the body and the hand is a part of the body. So you can map the hand onto the you know, and that's, so that's highly metonymic. And at the same time, it's still iconic also, you know. And I worked with Roman Jakobsen's ideas of metonymy and internal external contiguity, you know, and metonymy. So if you have one structure like the human body and you take one part of it, that would be, you know, in an interior contiguity relationship between the parts, and then you would have internal metonymy, you know, and that's very powerful. And then you said avoir would be something. J'ai frappé la porte, I knocked at the door. But avoir, for me, to have, is also something that you have something in your hands and you touch something. So this would be external to the body. And you might think of that as well. So if you're interested in that, I can point you to that work. So I hope I'm making myself understood. These are in this very brief instance. What else? Precise tools of semantics to get at the meaning of gestures, art, and performance. I would say, you know, I've been trying in my own work to use very basic concepts like image schemas, metonymy, metaphor, frames, and viewpoint to see how that works across semiotic systems and how structure can be meaningful and how, you know, more content like features and behaviors can become meaningful. So that would be one approach that one takes these very well-established theoretical concepts of I like to call them cognitive semiotic principles, and so that you can apply them to language as a semiotic system, but and also to other semiotic modes that are not as conventionalized and do not have this system as language, from within you can describe everything. So this freedom of semiotic expression poses a challenge to our work, but you know, it's interesting to see how gestures, co-speech gestures, are different from language and different from sign language, and what they have in common and in meaning making. And then there was something about at issue. He said, if something is at issue, that should make a difference relating to viewpoint. And that made me also think of Marion's presentation about Dominique's system, which I should look at more closely, about the motion capture. That's quite impressive that he has worked that out in such detail. I've seen him presenting this work, but there's something about epistemic stance, empathy, that you mentioned, and the values attached to it, and to see when something becomes salient, and the intention, communicative intention of speakers. They make something salient, something stands out from this semiotic multimodal complexity. And I would say that it makes a difference whether you apply character viewpoint or observer viewpoint, because if you look at something from a distance, you can still make certain schematic relationships salient, like in a diagram. But when people dare to become the character and be more of an acting, performing speaker, then it might become more salient, because it's also depending on the discourse genre and, you know, when we are not on a real stage, but we are just on our usual everyday communicative stage, how far do we go? How performative do we become? How much acting do we do? You know, so there are personality types, of course, but if I become Sylvester and I hop along the street, you know, in certain situations of certain moments, I might want to make the clown, and in teaching, for example, or with friends, but in others I can't. So I think maybe that is has something to do with the subjective import that we have, and that we can choose whether sometimes we can choose whether we become the person that we are talking about and we want to imitate. And something briefly to Jordan Slatter's work, bodily mimesis. He has this nice concept of mimetic schemas, right? And so I've been talking about image schemas, and that I'm also working in more or less in this realm of cognitive semiotics. So the mimetic schemas are more like actions, like that it has to do with children's gestures, you know, how to kiss, to run, to throw, and to so far. And the image schemas are at a higher level of abstraction. So they, you know, they may be part of these mimetic schemas, but I think it would be also nice to see at what point do these two schemata, types of schemata, work together. Okay. And now, very briefly, to those comments that I got, thank you very much. I'd like to say something about this. Some participants asked me, do we really need more concepts of viewpoint? Why can I not make sense of my data using character and observer viewpoint? Well, I tried. That's what I did. At first, you know, with the architecture student walking down the staircase, I tried to apply character and observer viewpoint. And I said, this is dual viewpoint, and I even presented it at a conference. And then I looked at this more closely to write a paper also, and I said, no, this is a lot more complex. And it should make a difference whether I talk about my own experience, I'm the experiencer, right, a subjective experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not a character in that moment. I'm myself. I mean, or, you know, a past self or a future self, you know. But I do not relate to a character in a story, in a cartoon story or in a play. I mean, of course, you know, I can go into those domains when I'm talking, but I would like to make that difference, that when you talk about these spatial experiences and there's no storyline and no discourse structure, that something else happens. And so I found this idea of experiential viewpoint in the literature, and I thought this is a good starting point, experience, cognitive linguistics, embodiment, anyway. So, and then I try to offer something that works with these spatial artifacts. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We try to synthesize everything, and maybe it's time also to leave you the floor. So please, if you want to ask question, take a mic, or if you signing, come here, and it will help. For the
Mm-hmm. I am Marianne Sanon, and I work here in Paris. Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask you if you observed in your data the two viewpoints combining simultaneously in your hearing gesturing, in your hearing participants, because it might be a difference between a hearing gesture and sign language, because in sign language corpora, we observe sometimes, but it's not rare, it's common, we observe the two viewpoints simultaneously. For example, when you have, for example, a driver like that, it's a personal viewpoint, and you have a second character, a second agent, who is crossing the road. Or for another example, a cat who drinks some milk, but the mouse here is looking at the cat simultaneously. It's what we call multiple perspectives or double transfer in other terminology. I would like to ask you if in gesture, hearing gesture, you find some simultaneously meaning combining, or if it's not very common. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. In my own data, I have not found exactly what you just described, which I know from the literature a little bit. I mean, the person standing up in the building where she lived as a child, looking down as if she was the mother watching her going down the staircase, is a little different, I guess, from what you just explained, but still it's a dual viewpoint, right? The person going down herself and somebody watching her, just that she was watching her. Well, so but I do know from the literature that some descriptions, for example, by Yves Switzer and Kashmir Steck, where they talk about how people go to an office and have a problem and talk to the office clerk, and they are everything at the same time. They're the person themselves standing there with their document, wanting to talk to this person, and then imitating how the person behind the counter looked. Yeah. So that is, I think, quite common, and it's always amazing how good people are at that, you know, how they can switch and mix and multiple viewpoints at the same time, mixing viewpoints. So I think there should be a lot more empirical work to see how that works for certain discourse types and languages, and how that interacts also with linguistic markers. But in my own work, since these people were more talking about spaces and their own experiences, there was not too much interaction with other people or blending these two things together. But I keep an eye on these things. Thank you.
So you describe some, again for Irene, sorry. I'm Carlo Cecchetto, and I'm also in this lab. You describe cases in which different speakers decided to adopt either an external or an internal perspective to describe an event. And of course, this is also familiar with sign languages, and what I was thinking about was the use of, for example, handling classifier as opposed to whole entity classifier. So if you want to describe toothbrushing, you can do something like this, or you can do something like this, okay? And so it has been proposed that sign languages may differ for a preference of handling classifier as opposed to whole entity classifier. So some languages will go more, of course, when it's possible, in one direction. I wonder whether, if in your own work or in some work by someone else in the field, you have described cultural differences of this type. So, for example, since you also work with people from North America, you mentioned, so if the choice of the perspective that is taken, external or internal, is at least partially culturally determined, culturally meaning belonging to a certain society or a certain language, maybe, or I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did some studies, but not really comparative studies, not yet, because at this point we are just interested in the phenomenon. And we are trying to make sense of it, and since for some time our research team was there were more American native speakers than German speakers, we did try to find American English speakers to come to our lab, and so we worked on English, but we did not really make an effort to have a comparative study, looking at German and English speakers. When you said internal and external, and you gave this example, yeah, is this for you internal and this is external, or what is? How did you? No, because it sounded a little bit like it. I was just trying to see how.
Well, I would say that. I personally would say that in this case maybe the most internal one is the handling, but I'm open to discussion for that.
Okay.
It's kind of difficult to be internal to a toothbrush. So,
I know.
But you can think about role shifting into inanimate objects, but not in this specific case.
I'm just wondering, because internal, external, sometimes that's a bit confusing. I've been using it myself. I totally agree. I sometimes you just wonder internal to what and external to what. So it's important to try to be precise about that. So we did have a study in our lab with a postdoc who works on human-computer interaction, and it was like a user study, looking at what people do, like these preferences. You know, we were a little bit familiar with this difference, also from a neurological point of view. And so we gave them before and after pictures, like a full apple on a plate and then the apple pieces of apple on a plate. And then we asked them, how do you get from 1 to 2? What do you usually do? Or what do I have to do to get from A to B? And then there was this, I have them with me, these video clips. I can show them to you if you like later on. You know, some did like the hand, and there was this imaginary apple, and you have another hand, and you have an imaginary knife, and you cut, right? Then there are others who did, and this, in my terminology that I have tried to develop, would be external metonymy, because there is an external relationship, contiguity relationship between the hand and the tool and the hand and the object, the apple, right? And opposed to that is internal metonymy based on interior contiguity relationships according to Jacobson and Peirce. So you have, there's another, Peirce is P-E-I-R-C-E.
Pierce.
Yeah, and Jacobson is with an K. And so, the other option would be my hand is the apple, and my other hand is the blade of the knife, and it goes like this, right? So that would be internal metonymy, because it's like one object, and you know you can actually see the parts of the apple coming out of it. So this is can only be imitating a knife in a certain way. So, and the more natural, what most people did, and was the pretending to hold a knife and to have this imaginary apple. But then if you want to make recommendations to gesture-based interfaces based on your user study for HCI, and you always have these imaginary objects, that's difficult to, you know, you don't, what do you have here if you don't have the speech that can tell you that there is an apple sitting there and not something else? It's difficult, you know, but our study participants all said that it is more natural to them to pretend to be holding the object and tool and not using their hands for object and tool. So that kind of goes into that direction for co-speech gesture.
Yeah, I have a very short question. My name is Annika, Annika from Germany, from Hamburg, professor at the Institute of German Sign Language. And I'm particularly interested in mental rotation. I put that on the note, and I was like looking at the pictures and how they were like performed or imitated, and some were rotated and some weren't rotated. So do you have like a Well, you probably don't have a quantitative analysis of all the things and all the pictures, but how would you speculate on do speakers rotate or not rotate? And do you maybe think of reasons why they do or why they don't do that? For example, with paintings. That would be very interesting for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. I have not, this was not a focus of my analysis, I have to say, and I only have these few examples. There was a tendency to mirror the figures in the painting because I think that was the easiest cognitively and also physically because they had this painting in front of them on the monitor and then the painting was gone and that is what they remembered and so they could align with this in way of mirroring it. Mm-hmm. If they had tried to rotate, and I think they would have that would have mixed them up, you know. And so you know, you said you saw one instance of rotating. I would have to look at that, but they most of the time, since it was there were these balanced gestures, was a little difficult to see the differences because they often did the wings of the angel with both hands. It was maybe the tendency of the leg that was different, but so I think compared to sign language, maybe also because I'm not a sign language linguist or I'm not a signer, I don't have this tendency. I'm not so good at this, maybe mental rotation, or I, it's not something I look for immediately, but I should more. Thank you.
I just have an additional comment. So maybe it also depends on the observer or the character viewpoint. Maybe the character viewpoint is rotated or the observer viewpoint is not. So that would be an interesting... The observer viewpoint may be rotated and the character viewpoint may not. So maybe there's also a relation that just popped into my head to think about that as well. So that might correlate at some point. I'll check that, I think.
That sounds very promising. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I have many, many questions, but seeing the time, I think I'm going to have to just actually concentrate on Fanny. You were talking about mimics and mimesis and embodiment and mime. So after your talk, I'm a linguist, so I'm looking at this from a linguist point of view when you're looking at mime versus embodiment. And when you're looking at what mime means, the definition of mime, currently they're saying it's the motor functionality, your everyday motor functions that you, motions that you produce, washing your hands, coughing, blowing your nose, your daily motions that you then can embody. And of course, then you have actually embodiment and character point of view, but I think that there's the major difference between the two is with mimesis, you know, when you're on the stage versus when you're signing, is when you are miming during sign language, signing, is you're also relating to a referent. Mime is not referring to a referent, but you are the referent. You are the person. And so maybe that's the difference between the two settings. But I'm curious from your point of view on this. This is what came up in my mind when I was listening to you, but I'm very curious what you think.
I observe very... I observe very different ways of miming in sign languages. So I observe very small mime or only just mimetic element only on the movement, for example, only on the parameter. So of course there's a lot of distinction to do when we work on linguistics. What I observed was that people, deaf people, signers themselves say that, it's easy to use international sign language, you mime, do mime, and you're going to be in international sign language. So during 5-6 years, this is what I saw. Mime. I've been in Hamburg in EFSLI, and there were a workshop on international sign language, and this is what was told to us. And also I saw that deaf teachers in front of hearing people also use mime to make them enter sign language, so to make them to make their visual cognition awake, and to also to make the body unrust. And to when something is rust, when the metal is rust, so yeah, the, yeah, you see,
rusted,
yeah. So to link all this, I think mime is a tool. That mime is something that has been very developed in artistic on stage. That even on stage, it refers to the world, to the material world. The performance, the artistic performance, exists for itself and has its specific codes and even many different codes. It depends if you're on the street.
Culture code.
Code. Yeah, this is coded also. And what I about mime being or pantomime being something, being a technique. Which was single or non-symbolic, many definitions. I look at mime performances and classical one, pantomimic, pure pantomimic one, and more modern one. And I find an artist named Joël Jeske. I use his work in my PhD, so I write the name. Excuse me, Preta. Yeah. So Joël Jeske. And you can find the video on internet. This is a solo, and you see the man being in pure pantomimic session. So he walk, drive,
yeah.
Go to work, call the elevator, and then you have a table and a cube, to symbolize the building, and it just point. No sound. He point at it, and so he jump to internal pantomimic mimic narrative strategy to external mimic one, but not something between. This is something different. External. And in French, we called the arts of mime, we call it les arts du mime et du geste. So mime and gestures, arts. There is complexity and diversity in mime. And the man in this show jump from one to another, external, internal, and also with strategies which are very close to linguistic semiotic strategies. So voilà. And I think the reference is outside. And sometimes he mix both because this is about suicide, with a burnout. So the man goes at the top of the building and jump. You see, external. But he scream. And then the man jump back to the top of the... So there's also humor. And you see here the yelling, the screaming and external. He makes both internal character personification, embodiment, what I call embodiment also, and external. And both make the meaning of the piece, of the artistic piece. Yeah, I had the video, but voilà, I show you.
I'm sorry, we have to stop. Or you keep your comment for the afternoon, or you want to just give a word of conclusion,
yes.
And then we have to go and eat.
Thank you, Maria.
And come back at 2.
This is very, very rich. Morning of exchange, and I think we have many things to share from different points of view on linguistics and semiotic. And here in our team, we are working with Christian Kukisak models approach. And in the beginning, he start with semiotic point of view. So we have many things to share, And I think it's about configuration, handling, as you said, brushing like that or like that's very interesting because we are working also in how sign language emerge and evolves. And I did my PhD and my research on emerging sign language practice in interaction with deaf and hearing children, but adults also. And it's very interesting to see that all in the beginning, all gestures come from the experience, and also knowledge share. It's the first level. And after things started to become other levels with internal and external perspective. So it's very interesting to see this linked with also when deaf people are in contact with hearing. Many things happen also. And with also children who doesn't have the opportunity to have sign language in the beginning, as show Goldie Meadow, that they started to create a language from experience and from shared knowledge. So I think we have many things to share. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for all this discussion. We continue in this afternoon.